Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people whose intelligence I've come to admire more, who have brought it to bear with greater effect for a long time in support of this country and its values and its security, most especially in this war for the free world, than our guest for this full hour. I'm very pleased to say he is Dr. Dan Gray, the vice president of the Lexington Institute. He has served in government as well, including 2 years as the director of the Office of Strategic Competitiveness in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. He has also been involved with a number of other organizations, notably the Center for Naval Analysis, the Science Applications International Corporation, better known as SAIC, and others. He has also been the deputy director of the International Security Program of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He is a voluble and highly regarded contributor to the public policy debate about defense and homeland security and a whole host of related issues, and he's one of our go-to guys. We're always delighted to have him with us, especially for an extended conversation. Dr. Gray, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure always, Frank.
Well, the pleasure is mutual, that's for sure. Let me just say, Dan, I've been very pleased to see that the Lexington Institute has brought its influence to bear in recent months on a topic that's very much on my mind, as you know, namely the vulnerability of our electric grid. And as it happens, just in the past day or so, we've had the Department of Homeland Security acknowledging that amidst all of this talk about the Russians and their influence operations and what they're doing in our elections and Claire McCaskill's pack and so on, they seem to have gotten inside our electric grid's control rooms, by some accounts hundreds of them, and presumably at least a few of the SCADA systems that are required to make them work and help us operate the most critical of critical infrastructures. Tell us what we should know about this latest development and, for that matter, what we can do about it.
Well, great issue. We know that the Russians have made attacks on infrastructure, particularly electric power, part of their whole military kit bag. We call it hybrid warfare, warfare in the gray zone, because a lot of this can be done without officially going to war or even without the guns having begun to fire. And in fact, if you go after the infrastructure, the guns may never have to fire. If you turn off the lights and the power, you win, however you do that. We also know that the Russians have successfully turned off a large part of the electric power grid in Ukraine. We have actual evidence of occurrences where they've done this. So it's not just hacking for hacking's sake. We know that the result can be that the lights do go out.
And Dan, I've been told that one of those attacks against the Ukrainian grid went after some of the same systems that operate ours, so that there would be, by some accounts, a signal sent to the United States, as it was at the time posturing to impose additional sanctions on the Russians, as I recall, that you better be careful, you know, putting us on notice by showing what we could do, they could, in that case, do to the Ukrainian grid. Dan, you've studied this closely, as in everything you look at, you understand, I'm sure, better than the vast majority of us, what the consequences could be should the Russians successfully turn out the lights in this country, not just for a day or two as they did in Ukraine, but for a protracted period of time.
Well, one of the things that people have to understand is this is not like turning off a light switch where all you have to do is go and turn it back on. Once you've created a large-scale failure, cascading failures, really, It takes a protracted period of time to get the grid and all the production facilities, all the producers of electricity, all the systems back online. It is an integrated system made up of thousands of small components, small and medium sized, depending on who's producing electricity. Public utilities do it, private companies do it, and all the rest. So if you can take down the grid electronically, it isn't a matter of just going back, and you may corrupt the software. You can cause failures that will actually physically then damage generators and turbines and transformers and that sort of thing, short them out. And once you started doing that, by whatever means, physical, cyber, EMP, there may be no replacements available. A lot of these SCADA systems you remain, those are the computer-based control systems. Some of them are very old. They are unique. The people who built them, the people who wrote the software for them, have long gone. They're kept patched up. If they go down in kind of a catastrophic way, you may have to wait years to get replacement capabilities in place. So power can go out and not be restorable by anybody.
And, you know, I guess it needs to be spelled out. What does America look like if it doesn't have power for a year or more?
At that point, there is no America. I mean, you're talking about, if you think about it, no power means you can't, you know, no water, right? All of our potable water goes through systems that are electronically driven in urban areas, at least. You've got no or very little heat in the winter. In fact, probably none, because you can't even pump the natural gas and oil. So you're out of your transportation doesn't work, your heat doesn't work, your water doesn't work, your electricity doesn't work. You're going to be, what, conducting operations in hospitals with candlelight if you can do that. You're not producing pharmaceuticals because that takes electricity. Everything depends upon electricity. That means you no longer have a country. What you have is going to be a wasteland, and most Americans after a year of this are dead.
It's chilling. You know, I came across a piece that colleagues of ours at Protect Our Power had published in I believe it's an online site, Governing, by Richard Moroz, who is a former chairman of the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners, their Committee on Critical Infrastructure. He is essentially urging that we stockpile, as a matter of some necessity, the transformers that are the backbone of the grid. You can stockpile all those you want, and that seems to me to be a sensible thing to do. Very expensive, very time-consuming, but necessary thing to do. But if you haven't shut down the vulnerability of the grid to these sort of cyber penetrations, to say nothing of electromagnetic pulse, and I want to talk with you after the break about that threat, Dan Garay, but we're going to still have a grid that is susceptible to enemy action, perhaps by others besides the Russians, but certainly putting our country at grave peril. So I wanted to say thank you for the work that you and your colleagues at the Lexington Institute are doing on this. We're happy to have you as teammates in this effort with our own Secure the Grid Coalition. There's plenty to be done here and not enough being done so far. Dan, we're going to pause for just a second. When we come back, we'll talk about a whole other vector for attacking the grid, electromagnetic pulse, with one of the country's experts on the subject, Dr. Dan Garay, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Dr. Daniel Garay is in the house, virtually, as they say. He is, of course, the vice president of the Lexington Institute, a former George H.W. Bush administration official, a man who is well known for his expertise and his clarity about the challenges that our country is facing and what we might usefully do about them, certainly here in Washington and I think around the world. Dan, we've been talking about a vulnerability this country has that I think most of us honestly don't have any idea of the gravity of our peril. If someone were to take advantage of the vulnerability of our grid in the ways we've just been talking about, the Russians inside our systems, the cyber threat that they've taken advantage of. Others seemingly have done as well. We've been told the Iranians have planted malware in our grid systems. I think the North Koreans have proven pretty adept at this sort of thing too, say nothing of the Chinese. But then there is this whole other, as I said earlier, threat vector, as they say in the military, that is extremely worrying because of the damage that it could do to things like the electric grids, transformers, and other critical components. Walk us through a little bit of this phenomenon known as electromagnetic pulse.
Well, generally speaking, electromagnetic pulse is the result of a detonation of a nuclear weapon in the upper atmosphere, which creates essentially this ionized pulse of particles. And it's like overcharging. You know, if you plug in too many things in your sockets, if you overcharge your home systems, everything shorts out. What you would do is essentially short out all things connected to electricity. So starting with the grid, the transformers, the transmission lines, and into every user, whether it's a household, a business, a factory, an office, your laptop computer.
Down to the chip level, right?
Down to the chip level, that's right, which essentially shorted all out. It is electronically flying the entire system. It also can be done with a nuclear weapon at an altitude that would essentially blanket the country. So you could essentially, with a single nuclear weapon, or at worst, best, at most, a few, handful, well within the numbers that North Korea has, that we worry that Iran will soon have, you could essentially turn every light out, all the electricity out in the United States simultaneously. And other than missile defense, which is important, there is no countermeasure. It's not like you can put software protection on your computers to protect hacking of a power plant. This is physical damage that needs to have all the parts replaced.
Well, let me just make sure I'm clear, because it's my understanding, Dan Garay, that there are things that you can do that, in fact, the United States military has been doing for decades to physically protect critical assets, notably their strategic nuclear forces and their communication systems and the like, what are called hardening techniques for essentially mitigating the impact that these various EMP pulses could have. That hasn't been done, needless to say, with respect to the civilian grid, even though the military depends critically, as you know, Dan, on the civilian grid for most of the bases in the United States and most of their critical missions. But there is known technology for reducing the vulnerability, increasing the resiliency, if you will, of those assets, is there not?
Yes, there is. I mean, you can essentially, it's almost like putting a surge protector in between the critical asset and the line, so that, you know, the effect will be mitigated.
And shunts and Faraday cages and those sorts of things.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. You can, but you've got to get off the dime and do it. And if we don't, we are still at risk of this. And the real kicker for me, Dan, is quite apart from whether any of these various bad actors might wish to take us down. And as you know, they all have a doctrine that says they want to, and they plan to, and they're getting, if they don't already have them, the capabilities to do that. So we ignore all that at our peril. But also, we ignore our extreme peril, the certitude that at some point in the not-too-distant future, we're likely to have a very intense solar storm. Talk a little bit about that and why that's a problem.
Well, you know, we tend to have the problem with high levels of solar radiation, and we have them periodically. Scientists, astronomers try and even predict them. We go through these kind of periods of intense activity, greater activity than that. And the solar storms can have some of the similar effects, particularly on very sensitive electronics. Now that we're entering a world of renewables, a lot of emphasis, particularly in Europe, parts of Asia, on solar arrays, solar power arrays for power, your system becomes more vulnerable, because essentially what happens is, particularly if it's industrial strength, but even the ones on your roof, you get an intense solar storm, and now what you get is the same thing, the surge. There was a case of this, I think, a year or two in Europe, you know, and it nearly shut the grid down because it sort of overloaded the system. It didn't burn it out, but essentially you've got an overload, and managing an overload of the system to prevent burnout means you end up having to shut things down. So we became very close to that in the European grid, particularly Germany, which is big on solar.
And this is just a function of how much surge you're dealing with too. If you get what's called a Carrington class event, which we haven't had since 1859, I believe, you can only do so much in terms of managing these things. At some point, it's just insuperably hard. But Dan, let me just ask you, because going back to, you know, enemy action as opposed to what Mother Nature might throw at us, there have been some of our colleagues, notably Dr. Peter Vincent Pry and Jim Woolsey, the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, who have been warning that in addition to ballistic missiles that could be used to lob these things into space, perhaps from quite some distance or perhaps from offshore on tramp steamers and the like, there also could be the use of satellites for this purpose. Have you looked at that, Dan, and in particular the prospect that two of the satellites now on orbit put up there by North Korea could have that as their mission?
Well, you know, what a ICBM with a warhead on it, the difference, let me put that, but, you know, an ICBM and a warhead on it and a space launch vehicle with a satellite maybe containing a nuclear weapon is almost indistinguishable. It's, you know, it's just a matter of sort of, do you have escape velocity and how do you, and when do you release the objects?
Well, the issue may be, do you have any warning? And in the case of a satellite that's on orbit, you may not have any at all. With a satellite where they missile, perhaps you might have a little, but not much.
We search the skies, so we try and keep track of at least known objects. But even if you think you know that it's up there and that it's orbiting in a certain way, doesn't mean you know what's on the inside of it. And therefore, there could be a bomb, and it could be just sitting in orbit. And once you deorbit it, you have an extraordinarily limited amount of time, assuming you were even going to attempt to intercept it. And that would assume some level of knowledge, if you will, or at least anticipation. So this could happen out of the blue. It could happen at the beginning of a crisis. You could just have the threat of it. Let's even talk about that. The North Koreans simply say, you know, we've been building bombs for a long time and we've been putting some things in space. And funny thing, one of those or two of those happen to have a nuclear weapon. And if you don't pick the, you know, the demand, we'll drop it on the middle of the United States. And once it goes off, that's it. You're gone. You can kill us, but you're completely gone. So not impossible. We know it can be done.
And this, I'm told, prospect of the grid's vulnerability being exploited by one hostile power or another, or as I say, natural forces, has prompted work to be done on a pretty accelerated basis by the National Security Council that now has a draft executive order for the president in the works. It's being vetted by other agencies of the government. I'm told the Department of Homeland Security, which has made this report about the cyber threat, is working to weaken this language, which is totally unacceptable as far as I'm concerned. But Dan, are you hearing anything about that? And how important is it, as you see it, that we have at that kind of all of government national level a concerted presidentially directed effort to remediate this vulnerability?
In securing the grid, securing our access to power is the number one national security issue when it comes to infrastructure. I mean, it needs to be raised to the presidential level because at that point, you can then begin to pressure the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Energy, the various regulatory bodies. A lot of this stuff has to be done, if you're going to invest in protective measures, has to be done at the state and local level where the utilities are and the transmission lines and all the rest. So you have to essentially start at the very top in order to get a concerted and, if you will, kind of coordinated response. And it is going to take years and years in any case to get it done, even if there's money and even if there's leadership. But it has to start with leadership.
Yeah, it has to start now, or better yet, a couple of years ago. But now is the best we can do. But I do hope this is forthcoming. And I know that the Lexington Institute will be working to ensure that it is faithfully implemented, as will we. Dan, this opens up so many other topics, and we'll be going through them in the remainder of our time with you today. But I did want to sort of, before we leave this subject area altogether, just ask you quickly about Iran, which, of course, is a strategic ally of North Korea, has been learning a lot about nuclear weapons and missiles from the North Koreans. There's reason to believe they may be cooperating on development of both. Just very quickly, Dan, we're seeing the president say he'll sit down and talk to these mullahs. What's your current reading on the threat posed by Iran?
Well, it is quite clear that Iran has taken two lessons, one from the situation in Iraq and one from North Korea. Iraq sort of stopped or was forced to stop its nuclear weapons program under Saddam Hussein. Saddam is no longer there. North Korea has a vibrant missile and nuclear weapons program. And the president of the United States meets with Kim Jong-un in Singapore. Need you say any more? That's the lesson for the Iranian.
That's an important takeaway. Dan, we have to pause for just a second. When we come back, I want to ask you a little bit more about the possibility of the president sitting down with the Iranians in this circumstance. We'll talk about that and a lot of other issues with Dr. Daniel Garay of the Lexington Institute right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Our guest for this full hour, I'm delighted to say, is Dr. Daniel Garay. He is a man that we work with closely and admire greatly, the vice president of the Lexington Institute. That is a nonprofit public policy research organization headquartered in Arlington, Virginia. He has served with distinction in the United States government. He was on the 2001 Defense Department transition team. He was the director of the Office of Strategic Competitiveness in the Office of the Secretary of Defense during the George H.W. Bush administration. He has consulted for the Departments of State, Defense, and Energy, and taught at, among other places, the National Defense University. A man of many parts from whom we have learned a great deal and are even as we speak. Dan Garay, thank you again for your time today. So we're talking about Iran. And the threat, as you say, the Iranians having learned from past experience, is only growing because they realize that if they have nuclear weapons, they're more likely to be able to withstand pressure to change or even their overthrow. Let me ask you about the advisability, given what the Iranians are up to with terrorism, with nuclear weapons, you know, activities and missiles and subversion and regional hegemonism and on and on and on, including in our own hemisphere, by the way. What do you make of the president's willingness to sit down and talk with them without preconditions?
You know, one can call it perhaps naive, as many people have done. I think that the president is, you know, a masterful negotiator, and this is sort of the carrot and stick. I mean, he continually wants to offer outs if countries like North Korea, Iran, even Russia are willing to take the proper steps. And to some extent, he has given them the benefit of the doubt, as, for example, on North Korea, touting what they have done. And, you know, it sets them up for the possibility of doing the right thing, the thing that we hope to see happen. But on the other hand, it really does put the ball in their court. So we, in some sense, make too much of, you know, presidential sit-downs like Singapore summit as if they are going to resolve everything. What they do is provide a potential crack in the armor. The door opens a little bit. But the president's made it very clear. He always expects that other side to walk through the door if he opens it. If they don't, it's back to sanctions, as it's the elimination of the JCPOA, the agreement with Iran, and it is going to be the strengthening of NATO and more sanctions on Russia. It's either carrot or stick.
Yeah. It is striking, having said all that, and I agree generally, Dan, that the president has nonetheless claimed in the aftermath of that one conversation with Kim Jong-un that he had eliminated the nuclear threat from North Korea. And I know you, even before this latest evidence that the North Koreans are actually still beavering away, surprise, surprise, at ICBMs, those long-range missiles with which they could attack our country, as we were discussing a moment ago. That does create, I think, an expectation, at least in some quarters, that more is being accomplished than one might like. If this is all about the art of the deal, as he says, then that's one thing. But as long as he's clear and the American people are clear that it ain't a deal until they've actually not only negotiated it, but fulfilled the negotiation. And that would be true in spades, it would seem to be, with respect to the Iranians, would it not?
Absolutely. But look, fundamentally, this comes down to the point that if these countries don't take the steps we've requested, then it becomes not just a possibility, but a likelihood that there will have to be a conflict to prevent them from acquiring those weapons or retaining them, in the case of North Korea, that can threaten us. So, and everybody then says, you know, we have to give diplomacy a chance and you have to go the extra mile. We're going the extra mile. This man has gone the extra mile. He is trying to continue to go the extra mile in order, in part, to say that if the day comes when there is no alternative but to take these weapons and the capability to produce them away from these countries, that we did everything possible. He did everything possible before that day came.
Yeah. Dan, you've studied these guys closely, and I think there is an important distinction, and it's one that the president has been making and others in administration for some time, between the mullahs, the theocrats, if you will, that misrule Iran, I should say, on the one hand, and the Iranian people on the other. There is a question, is there not, Dan, of the advisability of signaling a willingness to sit down with the Iranian leadership at the very moment when it seems as though its tenure is more and more uncertain?
Well, it's offering it out. I mean, we know that the Iranian economy is being hit extremely hard by the mere threat of reimposing sanctions after the JCPOA. It is only going to get worse from here. North Korea has had a recession, first time in a while. They were trying to improve the economy. So the screws are really being put to these countries, particularly Iran. And Iran is, in some sense, in the worst possible shape to withstand that kind of pressure. So opening up the possibility for discussion, essentially putting the onus for resistance on the back of the mullahs and President Rouhani is not a bad strategy at this point in talking indirectly to the Iranian people.
Well, my own feeling is we'd be better off talking to the Iranian people directly and not emboldening or otherwise legitimating the regime. But this is a topic that we could discuss at length. Dan, I do want to move to something else that we also need to discuss, and that is, in light of these threats, missile threats particularly, delivering weapons of mass destruction, and it could conceivably be the case that they would deliver something other than nuclear weapons, but that's the most worrying. You've mentioned earlier, Dan, that missile defense is something that you could use to try to protect against that. You followed for many years, Dan, the trajectory, if I could use that expression, of our missile defense programs. Notably, when I was in the Reagan Pentagon, we pursued something called the Strategic Defense Initiative. It is now being run by an outfit called the Missile Defense Agency. The Congress has been throwing gobs of money and creating new statutory direction for space-based missile defenses and defenses against hypersonic and maneuvering weapons, which are now emerging, particularly in the Chinese and Russian arsenals, and certainly will be in others, I suppose. What is your sense of the state of our missile defenses and their adequacy for dealing with today's threats, let alone those that are now on the horizon?
Look, for whatever progress we made, we are actually still being outpaced, outrun in the race by our adversaries, whether it's with respect to numbers of systems, their location, number of interceptors, the ability to actually track and identify warheads in space so that you can put an interceptor down, the sensor systems. We have been spending a lot of time on it and have not made the necessary progress. And now, on top of that, you have maneuvering warheads, you have hypersonic weapons, all of which requires yet an additional set of technologies and sensors in order to be effective. So for whatever we've done, the game needs to be upped and we need to redouble our efforts or we are going to be vulnerable to the kind of strikes, preemptive strikes and such, that could in fact neutralize our deterrent, much less destroy this country.
This is, again, something that I think probably most of us have stopped even wondering about, let alone thinking hard on, Dan, going back to probably, well, the end of the Cold War, that, you know, we were the world's only superpower and we could maintain this modest missile defense system, which was actually, as you know, designed to just protect us against relatively small threats like North Korea's or what may be coming from Iran. Certainly not to interfere with the Russians and Chinese, both of whom have been feverishly building up their nuclear capabilities, while ours has been more or less maintained in a somewhat obsolescent state, I think it's fair to say. So, Dan, as you're looking at this and you're watching Vladimir Putin at the Helsinki summit lay out in the press conference afterwards, sort of his ambitious agenda, which I have to say sounded pretty much like the old Soviet agenda of limiting our missile defenses, limiting our strategic forces, locking in what I think may be superiority on their part at this point. All of it without any regard for the fact that there's this whole other entity out there, China, which is also increasingly a threat to us. So walk us through all that, if you would, Dan.
Well, everybody is racing ahead with nuclear modernization except us. I mean, people keep talking about if we spend money on nuclear weapons modernization, we are creating an arms race. No, the arms race has not only begun, but they've outlapped us three or four times as this has gone forward. There are new nuclear weapons, new designs. The Russians have a new heavy ICBM they're putting forward, a new nuclear submarine, ballistic missile submarine they're putting forward, a brand new land-based cruise missile, long-range cruise missile, which violates the INF treaty. Essentially, that treaty is dead, gone. They did this all, by the way, that last piece, during the Obama administration. The man who sort of wanted to reset and was giving them everything they wanted, they still went ahead. They went ahead with development all through the Obama era, and they actually went ahead with deployment just before the 2016 election, when everybody seemed to think it was going to be Hillary Clinton who was going to be president. They didn't stop their effort whatsoever. So they are looking for, in effect, nuclear war waging, nuclear superiority capabilities. That's just the Russians. Chinese are steadily moving ahead. The North Koreans, right? You talk about ICBMs. They're trying to put nuclear missiles on some of their older submarines so they can approach the coast by stealth, get under our defenses. And then you have the Iranians who are getting assistance from everybody and learning how to do it right the first time. And against that, we have an extremely limited missile defense. We are putting in theater capabilities, whether it's THAAD or Aegis Ashore or upgraded Patriot.
These are anti-missile systems, not countervailing systems to theirs like we had during the INF deployments that preceded this Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Dan, so much more to talk about on that, but we have to take one last break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about space and how it fits into maintaining America's strategic advantage. That and much more with Dr. Daniel Gouret of the Lexington Institute. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are now in our fourth leg of this very important conversation with Dr. Daniel Gouret, one of the truly influential and leading figures when it comes to thinking about and developing policies for the future security of the United States. It's always a delight to talk with him, and this is certainly an example of why. Dan, we've been talking about so many different things. I think put together, they give a sense of a very challenging time for the United States, a time in which we had best be alive to the burgeoning number of national security threats, or at least challenges we face. And for many of us, space has been one of the places that we've realized is likely to be determinative of the future security of countries like ours. We depend upon it, of course, not just for military purposes, but for a whole and largely ever-expanding number of civilian and commercial and economic imperatives as well. The president has, Dan, as you know, recently announced that he wants to create a new space force, something that Vladimir Putin in his speech at the summit press conference seemed intent on trying to head off. Tell us a little bit about what you think the president has in mind and whether, in fact, he will be thwarted in its pursuit, either by Russians and arms control deals or the Congress, perhaps.
Look, the military now says, our intelligence officials, but the military leadership now says space is a domain of warfare. We are no longer in a world in which we could blithely think that space would be sacrosanct. It would be free of conflict. Our adversaries are developing, particularly Russia, China, but others, anti-satellite weapons. There's a whole variety of ways of doing that. You can shoot things from the ground, lasers or anti-satellite missiles that can go up. You can put up satellites that act to interfere with other satellites. You could even, if you were so inclined, detonate nuclear weapons in certain parts of orbital planes in space, and all the satellites that would go through would essentially get fried, much like we were talking about EMP against the ground. We can expect that a future conflict with a major power, or one just has a capability, an Iran or North Korea, will not only involve attacks on facilities on the ground through cyber and electronic warfare and that kind of thing, but will also involve early on, if not from even before we know the war started, attacks on space assets, our communications assets, our intelligence collecting assets, even potentially our early warning assets. And I think what the president is doing is sending up a flare, so to speak, a rocket that says, look, if we're going to be fighting here, we need to get serious about putting together the capabilities. A space force means people. It means equipment. It means doctrine. It means tactics. It means war plans, all those kind of things, for a fight that may start in space, even be limited to space, but certainly in a big war include space.
Yeah, and probably won't end there, for sure. Dan, one of the countries that, of course, is as you say, heavily investing in this, particularly in some of those more exotic space control technologies like microsatellites and satellites that can, you know, serve as kind of mines, move amongst other satellites and neutralize them and the like, is Communist China. I had a fascinating hour-long conversation yesterday with Stephen Mosier, and we talked a lot about what China's up to and the challenges that its historic as well as current ambitions represent for supplanting the United States as the world's dominant power, as a CIA official said last week. And as you look at China and against the backdrop of all of the other threats, do you agree with Steve Mosier that this is the most formidable of the bunch?
There's no question for the long term. Russia is a declining power right now, and for years to come, we have to worry about its nuclear capability. We have to worry about its capability to go after conventionally states just along its periphery. But it does not pose the threat to the world in the way that China intends to. China is currently doing. He does not seize territory in the scale that China has done with the South China Sea. It does not seek to now put military facilities all around the world. It's doing its little part. What I'm really terrified about is what we are going to get is, in effect, a de facto Russia-China axis, each of which operating, if not in concert, at least collaboratively, to put increasing pressure on the U.S. and its allies. And as a result, essentially force us at the minimum to make a choice between, you know, defending in the West, defending in the East, but potentially cause us to overstretch the force in all kinds of dimensions. And it may break in the pressure to defend everything.
Well, that brings me to the last topic, Dan, and it's an open-ended question, but let me just give you a couple of minutes to work through it with us. The force is susceptible to breaking because it has become, as you know better than just about anybody, very overstretched, very hard-worn, very, well, obsolescent in a lot of different respects. I remember back in the Reagan years, you know, making the investment on equipment that we're still relying upon, particularly in the nuclear space. So give us a sense, Dan, if you could. You've been writing about this at Lexington and Real Clear Defense and elsewhere. Where are we in terms of the adequacy of our military, the rebuilding of it that the president clearly has set his sights on, and the adequacy of that rebuilding to the tasks that seem to be looming now?
Well, with all due respect to the efforts the president have made, and he's done and the Republican Congress a yeoman's job, that's the right word, to provide relief from some of the constraints, to provide additional resources, to open up the system. We are trying to repair the damage of decades of underfunding and overstretch and overuse.
And wrecking, I would argue, under the Obama administration. Yeah. Let's be clear.
And even wrecking. So you're talking about having to simultaneously modernize what you have to keep it going, to prove the sustainment system so that you're not having half of your Navy F-18 fighters out of action for lack of spare parts and opportunities for maintenance, lack of training opportunities. We are funding flying hours in Congress. We don't have enough aircraft in the Air Force and Navy to actually use all of that. So this is becoming continuous. And then beyond that, you have to modernize. We need the next generation, our own hypersonics, our own heavy, new fighting forces. We need to redeploy forces to Europe. So we need to do much more, having even done all that we have done to date.
Yeah, unquestionably. And Dan, I did want to just hone in on something you said a moment ago and that you've written about, I believe, at Real Clear Defense. This issue of sustainment, that speaks to not just readiness, it speaks to an industrial capacity to maintain the force and the hangar queens and the ships that are tied up for want of overhauls and so on are symptoms of having necked that contractor and industrial capability excessively, are they not? And is that being addressed as a priority as you see it?
It is starting to be addressed. For example, Lexington Institute, but others have been fighting to keep the Lima tank production facility, the only one this country has, open when the Army wanted to shut it down. We're now, because of the Trump administration, going to be producing 135 modern versions of the Abrams tanks a year. So we're bringing that back with the jobs, and those tanks will now be an additional capability to deter Russia. But you're talking about single points of failure, single facilities for ammunition, for tanks. We are trying to maintain, and the administration is pushing very hard to maintain, a U.S.-flagged commercial transport fleet. Small number. And people fight this, the Jones Act and such. These are absolutely critical in order to have the ships that the U.S. Navy and all U.S. forces can count on going to war, and the infrastructure on shore repair facilities to repair either commercial vessels or war vessels when the war starts. We are fighting a war to sustain the industrial base to ensure that in the event we deterrence fails when we go to war, that we can in fact fight through that war, produce more stuff, repair the stuff that gets broken. And we are on the ragged edge of not having that industrial capability.
Dan, this is all evidence of a problem that I call a lack of national security mindedness. And one of the reasons we do this program and that we benefit so much from extraordinary talents like yourself is to try to raise awareness among our countrymen and women as to what it will take to assure our future security. And I am so grateful to you, Dan, for your time today, as well as for the great work that you do day in and day out at the Lexington Institute and in so many other ways. I hope that you will come back to us again in the very near future. And again, thank you for your time today, and I look forward to our next conversation soon. I look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Effney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.